Hey there, welcome back. Thanks for tuning in today. Great to have you here. I'm Henrik from Sweden, and you are listening to Red Ice Radio, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. We discuss all the things that are most pressing in our times: controversy, critique and analysis, opinions, research and theories. We cast a wide net and highlight a lot of different topics. Gregory Sams is our guest today, and we are going to discuss today's disenchantment over the top-down power structure that increasingly manages our lives versus the beauty of bottom-up self-organization that exists in nature. Our culture's most essential and reliable features come into being without central planning and state enforcement. Gregory Sams has been a health food pioneer from the 1960s. In 1967, he and his brother Craig introduced organic and natural foods to the UK marketplace. After 15 years of catering, Seed Magazine, Ceres Grain Store and Bakery, Harmony and Whole Earth Foods, in 1982, Gregory conceived and christened the original Veggie Burger. In 1980, he also became fascinated with the scientific ideas of chaos theory, so he founded Strange Attractions, a shop dedicated to chaos theory. Sam's lifelong passions, health, culture, and consciousness, culminated in two books. And today we're going to talk about one of them, The State is Out of Date. And welcome back, Gregory Sams. It's great to talk to you again. It was over 4 years ago we spoke last time, so it's nice to hear your voice again. How have you been?
I've been very well, and it's great to be back on Red Ice.
Thank you. Excellent. It's great to have you here. We spoke a little bit about the subjects we were going to get into here today last time you were with us, specifically in the second hour. But since that time, a lot of things have happened with the book. The State is Out of Date. A lot of things have been updated in the book and new versions out. There's a lot of good stuff in this book with some great points in regarding to, natural self-organization, talking about the problems that arise with the state, etc. Let's talk about the problem first before we get into some of the issues of what can be done about this, etc. But why did you want to write the book? I mean, you said you wrote it way back. When was the first edition released again?
The first version came out in 1998.
1998.
It was very ahead of its time. People still thought that the government was going to sort things out if they had enough taxes and put enough thought into it, that they would solve things. But I think more and more people are now disillusioned with the state, to say the least.
Well, that's a good thing, I guess. That's something we have actually working in our favor. At the same time, though, they've managed to create a lot of havoc in their wake, unfortunately. How bad do you think it has to get before people start, en masse waking up to this issue and really starting to question the state as a whole? Because still a lot of people are at the level where they just say, well, we just need the right people in there, right?
Yeah. People just want to tweak the knobs and get new policies and new faces in there. Yeah. But that's been happening so much lately that I think people are starting to realize, whether it's in the Ukraine or in Egypt, that whoever gets in, they're not doing the job. It's the same old with different packaging. But people don't really know where to turn, and people think that this top-down state is a necessary evil. They think, well, this is better than anarchy and chaos. What would happen if we didn't have them? But when you actually look at what they are doing, it's worse than anything that you could imagine. So that's really, people have got to stop thinking about getting a new package. And what is happening is that states are collapsing. You know, they're propped up on smoke and mirrors. And we may, before too long, be in a situation where it does collapse. And that's an interesting opportunity for us.
Yeah, well, exactly. It is. I mean, the issue that has arisen, I see really clearly in the last 10 years, maybe even a little bit less, but this idea that the state cannot appeal to everyone. It cannot centrally decide and dictate over everyone of what to do. I mean, we have a perfect example of that in the European Union, of the absurdity of what they're doing with their laws and rules and regulations and everything else. But even just the concept of democracy is actually it's very old, right? This concept of majority rule, of having 51% dictating over the 49, potentially even over a question where the 49 actually is going to suffer quite extensively. I mean, we have to rethink all of this. We have to come up with new models here, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a very flawed system, and democracy, the main thing it does is it has more pigs feeding at the trough, because we've got all these people claiming to represent us, but they're just following the party line and voting how they're told to vote. It's the same structure we've had for not forever. I mean, we've only had it for 5,500 years on the face of the earth, and only, you know, a couple thousand years in the UK and England and Northern Europe, and maybe for a few hundred years in North America. But this idea of one group of people deciding top down what what most of the people have to do. And that's, it's never been as intense as it is today, though, because it was always the main purpose of the state was to protect us from possible invaders, from other versions of themselves who want to come in and tax us and take our land, our women, our money, or whatever. And that's what government has always, that's its core raison d'etre. In the last century and a bit, it's expanded into, you know, what shape your house is, how many hours a week you can work, how many months you get off if you're a female and you've had a baby, what sort of language you can use when you're talking about people of other sexes or colors. And it's this incredible intrusion into our lives. And every time there's a little disturbance, they think, well, we need more control, more, you know, tight guidelines on what people can and cannot do. And it's just, that's the wrong way to do it, because we're really good at doing that stuff ourselves without the controls from above.
Well, exactly. The absurdity, just, it's out of control. I mean, just look at the PC police that have arrived lately on the scene. All of this is just an expression of a system that's been in place a really long time. And when you try to run other people's lives, when you try to micromanage them, I mean, look at the results of that and the chaos that that's creating. So again, maybe that's something we do have working in our favor in that regard. But let's back up a little bit then. I mean, Okay. Obviously, I want to get in and talk more about the problems of what the state has, you know, Right. Created and anarchy and chaos, the security issues and questions that arise when we have these kinds of discussions. But how were things before the arrival of the state? Maybe we can just kind of philosophize on that a little bit. How were things run? How did mankind manage to survive without a state for tens of thousands of years, right?
Well, very well. But we don't have a lot of history on it. You know, civilization goes back at least 8,500 years, possibly longer. Graham Hancock keeps pushing the boundaries back a little bit more, further, bless him. And up till about 2,500 BCE, there's no evidence of that top-down coercive state. And we had civilization. We had up to 20 cities in Mesopotamia who were operating independently of each other, run by free men. There was no slaves, no ruling class, but they had trade, they had artisans, they had architecture, they had spirituality and temples, though they weren't ruled by priests. They brought goods down from the mountains and traded them. They were well-developed civilization. And there's no evidence of any top-down control there. And then it started to deteriorate with Sargon of Akkad, who raised and killed the king, took over, went out and created the first empire, conquering 20 other cities in Mesopotamia, leveling the one that dared resist. In the Indus Valley, you also had several thousand years of a very highly developed civilization with scores of cities, standardized measures, normal housing. There was no signs of people living in palaces and people living in hovels, no evidence of top-down control, but we haven't deciphered their language yet. Of course, most of these old civilizations didn't have written language yet, because that came in with taxation, and with taxation came standing orders, because that's the only way you can have, you know, 1,000 or plus men doing nothing but waiting to kill other people. There was another one in South America, the Tiwanaku civilization in Bolivia, thrived for 14 centuries without top-down control. It was very community-oriented, very cooperative. They expanded into an empire in their last 600 years, again, without warfare. They were invited by people in Chile and Peru saying, hey, yeah, you've got a really good scene going there. come share it with us. We want to be part of your culture. And they had huge celebrations, festivals where they took psychedelic plant medicines. They knew how to brew beer out of corn. They worshiped nature spirits in the sun. They had great architecture. I mean, a good civilization. The Mayans had 2,000 years of early Mayan culture was, again, without a nobility. They came in nearer the end of the Mayan Empire era. You know, there are probably lots of other places around the world we don't have records of, but in medieval Europe for just a few centuries, you had city-states in northern Italy, then they developed, moved some into further parts of Europe. And these city-states had kicked out the nobles. They built walls around themselves. They self-governed. They had medieval communes where people would get together and they would sort things out. Businesses had trade guilds to regulate the business so that you didn't have architects building houses that fell down or bakers putting sawdust in the bread. They self-managed because we're really good at that sort of stuff. And Florence had to expand its walls 3 times. The city did so well. It was the engine of the Renaissance. And they had, you know, universities, schools, hospitals, a population of 90,000. They did really well. So we've got examples of us doing this in the past. But of course, history is written by the victors, and we're usually reading about wars and conquests and generals and presidents. And of course, they didn't have any of those standard ingredients that we call history.
Yeah. There's a lot of interesting things there. I mean, I want to get into some of the things about like the free market concept and what has happened today with everything. And again, over-regulation of how things are run. But the God-King concept is an interesting one in that regard, historically speaking, from a perspective of mankind, how long we've been around is a fairly new concept. It's of course, a religious concept as well. But just this concept that there are a natural order to how things run. There arise a natural hierarchy, not a tyrannical hierarchy, but how things function within a tribe or a society or mm-hmm. a culture. I mean, there arise sets of morals and behavior. You know, people are they raise their children. It's something that is natural. It just happens that way, right? But yeah. We have yeah. things coming in here later, like, you know, I guess Hammurabi is one of the early ones that actually writes down the law. It goes from just a set of behaviors that are, to a certain extent, taught to something which is enforced and written in stone, and this is it. It has to be kind of worshipped on a stone, you know what I mean? That's a different concept there.
I mean, we didn't need tablets from God to tell us it's bad to kill other people and sleep with their partners.
Right, yeah, exactly, right. Yeah, it's very interesting. And then, so let's talk a little bit more here about how you approach some of the subjects here. And let's just kind of churn out some of the problems that have arisen with the state as it has been enforced. We have issues of course, decisions being run above our heads. That's, I guess, the most recent one. We used, the concept was that we were supposed to live in a democracy. And I guess that would have been a little bit better, at least, if we were in a position where we actually could participate in the actions that the state does. We get to vote. Do you want to go to this war? Yes or no? You know, let's see how it turns out, right? But this is now even, it goes above our heads. Decisions are made above our heads. Taxes are taken, money is taken from people. Initiation of force. There's just so many problems that arises with the state. Maybe we can talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, nobody wanted to go to war in Iraq. But nevertheless, the state took us to war. And I think democracy started off in the United States of America. And it was an earnest attempt to create a minimum top-down structure that couldn't grow. They had all these sort of checks and balances in there. And because they really didn't want another George III. And that's why so many Americans, you know, hold on to that treasure, that a constitutional right to carry arms, because that was put in there so you could stop anybody else from ever taking control. And of course, all those rifles aren't going to help, you know, fight the American Uncle Sam when he comes down on you. But that was the idea. And it was really because government was so small for the first half century or more of the United States that culture thrived, because it was self-regulating, it was free to develop, and it became the one of the greatest powerhouses of the world in cultural melting pots and also cultural developing places. But then, of course, the state got bigger, and the nature of a state is to accumulate more and more control, more and more power. And as the American economy boomed, there was more and more for the state to feed off of. And it just kept taking more and more money and saying, well, we'll look after this, we'll look after that. And if you go back a couple of centuries, taxation never reached beyond 10%. It was usually 2 or 3%. And that's what it took to keep the kings and the nobles going. If there was a big foreign war going on, the taxes would go up. They'd put people in uniform. When the war was over, the taxes would go back down again.
Right.
Now, you know, when you add in all the taxes, it's 50% or more of everything we earn.
In Sweden, it's like 70, approaching 80 now, you know.
I know. I'm reading you work till Thursday afternoon for the state, and then
exactly. It's unbelievable, you know. I don't know how people put up with this. It's amazing, is it? Because of the same situation arose in Sweden. I remember that when there was like a tax revolt over basically when it was like one third of what it was now, and the farmers ganged up in Sweden and marched towards Stockholm to like, and the king was almost toppled because of that rebellion that arose from that. Today, the complacency, it's mind blowing, you know, how much people are taking, you know?
Well, there's a great quote from the finance minister for Louis XIV in France in the 18th century, who says, he defines taxation. He says, the art of taxation consists of so plucking the goose as to obtain the maximum amount of feathers with the minimum amount of hissing.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's it. So they talk to us about redistributing the wealth and looking after this and looking after that. And it's all just these ploys to take more and more money. I mean,
In the
UK, about just over 12% of the total tax take gets redistributed in benefits, and the rest goes into things that we're either things that we don't want at all or need at all, like, you know, the third or fourth largest military force in the world, or into things that we could easily finance ourselves. When you divide the amount that goes to the educational budget by the number of students in the country, it's costing as much as it does to send children to private schools like Harrow and Eton. Mm. It's just incredible expense. I mean, they put somebody in jail and it costs £40,000 a year.
How can it cost that much? It's just unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know?
And that might be because they didn't. I mean, I've got a criminal record because I didn't fill in the census
right
a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. Now, had I refused to pay that £300 fine, that they'd have put me in jail.
Right.
£40,000 a year. I mean, it's just an insane system.
And then you raise another good point there, that people are naive as well, that because it's an appeal to our guilt complex, right? On one hand, we're being told how bad and egotistical we are. And then at the same time, then the state comes in as this good, you know, guiding God force almost, that's supposed to redistribute all this and equalize everything and come with equality. But I mean, let's just examine that for a second. I mean, the state is, on one hand, is appealing to the fact that it claims to provide, I guess we say, quote, free stuff, unquote, you know, healthcare and education and, you know, food and housing in some cases as well. But at the same time, then they fail miserably at actually, you know, providing these things. In other words, they provide a really bad service. What would happen if we were to remove that system? I mean, I've always been a believer in if there are, you know, not abilities like everyone else has, that there is a good charitable heart in most people and that things would actually run. I mean, look, America has had a tradition of a lot of good charity work and things actually being run outside of that paradigm, as opposed to somewhere in a really strict socialist country like Sweden, where things are progressively getting worse and worse when it comes to these services that are they're supposed to offer for, you know, quote, free, unquote, right?
Mm-hmm. So in America, they've got an open health system, but it's completely controlled by the state. The pharmaceutical industry has had pushed so many laws through the government that if you want to be a masseur or an acupuncturist or do shiatsu with hands-on touching, you need a certificate and you probably need to go through 4 years of medical college.
Right.
before they'll allow you to do that. And it's, and if you, and they're, you've got three lobbyists from the pharmaceutical industry for every single senator and congressman in America. And their whole job is to convince that those people, and they're good at it. They've got the figures and the tables and the charts and the research to convince these people that Americans, that it's in the interest of the public for kids to be vaccinated.
Right.
So they pass laws and people have had their children taken away from them because they refuse to have them vaccinated.
Yeah.
Water is fluoridated because the aluminum industry convinced them that that's where the waste fluoride comes from, convinced them that this was going to be good for your teeth. And it's so hard for them to roll these things back once they start doing them. And on the health, it's, you know, people are really treasure the English National Health Service as, you know, it's like mom and apple pie in America. It's this sacrosanct thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they don't realize that in up till 1911, we had developed our own National Health Service. And you had things called friendly societies that 98% of British workers subscribed to. And they paid a little bit of money every month or week into this friendly society. And that was take care of their medical costs, their doctor's bills. Somebody would go around the house to see that their family was okay. And if they were faking it, not playing golf, they'd be caught out on that, of course. And it was a really efficient system. There were 20,000 different friendly societies in the British Isles. So no one of them could be taken over or lobbied by the pharmaceutical industry. And they were all tailored to local circumstances, local needs. The coal miners had different needs to the fishing towns.
Exactly.
And it was, again, it was a combination of people going to the government. In this case, it was the large insurance companies and doctors lobbied the government hard to come in with the National Insurance Act because we have to look after the 2% who weren't covered. Because what happens if, you know, somebody's not covered and they lose their job and their children are starving? And the whole societal structure ends up being built to service 2%. Instead of 98%.
Exactly. How is that fair? You know,
it's not fair. And those 2%, you know, hopefully they'll have family or friends or people they know who would help them out in that crisis.
Yeah.
And maybe they won't, but we, you know, we can't all sacrifice for that. And I object. I've been introducing, I started off when I was 18, introducing the first natural and organic foods to this country. And I, you know, in concert with my brother Craig. And I've been eating really well all these years. I look after my health. I don't go to the doctors. And I resent having to pay for somebody's heart transplant smoking and drinking and eating hamburgers all their life.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's a good point. I don't see how people take that. And the flip side of that as well, then, which is another dangerous aspect, is that when these systems begin to catch on to this stuff, they'll also at that point begin to tell you how you can live and not live, because exactly this will drive out the prices. And I mean, is that really the way to deal with it? Instead of saying then, all right, you're free to live your life how you want, but you have to take the responsibility for that. You have to take the consequences of that lifestyle, right? As opposed to what might happen now if we go into a full-on tyrannical model where you basically, you know, you can't have a slice of pizza if you want to because the state deems it's going to drive up your insurance costs or something like that. There's these nightmares, you know, scenarios out there that have been speculated upon when people, you know, call to the pizza place and how much that ends up costing you at the end of the day, mm-hmm. because the state has these enforcements and everything else on it. So it's going to be this, in other words, could lead very easily to a tyrannical system very, very quick, more than it is now, you know?
Yeah, that's the only tool that the government has in its armory is coercion. I mean, when they give subsidies, that's of course based on money that they've coercively taken through taxation.
Yeah.
But their basic tool on these health matters is do this or don't do this, or we're going to damage you somehow. And that's not the way to get positive results, because the way that we evolve and develop as a society is through feedback loops where I invite you to dinner. And I ask, are you vegetarian? And you say, let's say I'm making fish for dinner. You say, yes. Well, at that point, I can say, oh, you're not invited, or I'll make something special for you. And then you respond to that and say, oh, he's a nice guy, or what a shit. And then maybe the second person I call is also a vegetarian. And I say, well, I'm in that. I might say, well, can the fish, I'll make it vegetarian for everybody. And then everybody might like it and say, well, hey, we don't need to have fish or meat on a meal. And that's just a feedback loop, reaction, response, change. That's how we evolve and develop as a society. And when you come in and say, no, you will eat fish, or you're not going to be able to serve this, or the government, when they thought that we should all eat more meat, they started to subsidize the factory farm and just do everything they could to make meat cheaper. And then we end up with this terrible quality meat and people living on hamburgers and fried chicken.
All the hormones in it and everything else. You know, yeah, I never eat that stuff.
All of that crap. And they just, you know, coercion's fine when you're trying to see off Hitler or Genghis Khan. But when you're modulating people's health and what they eat and what sort of house they live in, and that's not the right tool. That's not how we operate as human beings. And we do so much without it. I mean, everything you look at in the world, it's very hard to find anything that the state actually created or brought into being, whether you're talking about canals, airplanes, cars, smartphones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is all individual achievements, right? Yeah.
It's all stuff we do. And, you know, we wouldn't miss them at all, frankly.
Yeah, it's a good point there. And the communication line that you mentioned there, the feedback, of course, works better the smaller the system is, like individual small cells, as opposed to this huge, massive centralized system. And just one more point on the healthcare system there as well, because I've always questioned the much praised systems of some of the European countries. Again, people have heard about the Swedish healthcare system forever, you know, and it's, of course, not much to praise anymore, if it ever was. But nonetheless, look at the what they're offering in that regard. I mean, if you want to go to a naturopath or something, good luck. I mean, there are no other services around. What is it that they're offering? Or the so-called orthodox medicine system, you know, we're talking about just the things you brought up, you know, vaccinations, the chemical issue to it, the pharmacologicals, you know, orientation around how to get well, chemotherapy, all this stuff, you know. So it's like you end up in a position where you cannot choose anymore and there's nothing else available. And if there are things available that will operate outside of the health budget that the state has done, so you end up paying twice for it. You first pay, you know, forcibly you have to give the taxes for it. And then secondly, you either have to have a private insurance on the side of it. And that's actually happened now in Sweden, which is very bizarre. Or if you want to go to a, you know, naturopath or homeopath, if they're even around, you mm-hmm. have to pay for that separately out of your own pocket. So you end up paying twice, you know. So this is,
I know,
it's just bad all over, you know.
I know. Do you have the Chinese herbalist in Sweden?
I guess there is a few around here and there, but
there's a lot in England. They spread across this country, and it's interesting. They've done really well, and their goal is to heal people. They don't want to get you on something and keep you coming back every week. They try and sort you out. Mm-hmm. They're doing very well, and I just think it's amusing because the competition is free, and people choose to go to the Chinese herbalists.
Exactly.
let me rewind a bit, because you mentioned, you know, how important small, you know, how much small smells, excuse me, small cells work better. Mm. And that's true. But the main reason for that is because there's connectivity. People are connected in an intimate way in a smaller cell. And what we have in the internet is a huge cell, but the connectivity is still there. And that works when it's put to use, because it's also free. The government might suck all the data out of it, but they're not controlling it in the West yet. And we have these fabulous things like Airbnb and Uber with cars and, you know, borrowmydog.com, where we're developing systems that are person to person. So you have that small cell syndrome, but in a worldwide cell,
sure,
where people say, yeah, this guy's a great guest, or this person's a great host, make sure you have his muffins for breakfast, and it's intimate. You really know what's going on, and we're connected, and that's a fabulous development. And of course, the hotel industry and the car industry will try and lobby government to stomp this out, and I just hope that they are not successful. Because it's a great alternative to the corporate behemoth that we all abhor. People getting together in large numbers and doing stuff like that.
Exactly. Let's talk a little bit about the role of the state as well in terms of, I guess, the religious question. You have a chapter in the book, playing God, basically. And it's a really good point, some good points made in there as well, because as we were talking earlier, we talked about that this, the God-King concept and all these things, that it's like it came from somewhere else. It was kind of a divine plan of sorts. And I mean, of course, the priest class or the priestarchy have kind of manipulated this in human beings as well, as we've gone superstitious and whatnot. But the fact is, as much as some states, some governments and nations around the world have started to walk away from the religious system, to me, Gregory, it almost seems like the state has now supplanted that role. It's becoming, if it isn't already, it's slowly becoming a new version of God that is to be worshipped. That's going to be this omnipotent, all-knowing, all-seeing force in the world that's going to sort everything out for you, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's summed up, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Well, God doesn't go around with a bag full of thunderbolts knocking us out when we do bad things. And it's this whole misinterpretation of, heaven and God is this absolute authoritarian character telling us what to do. And as you say, that model has been implanted on the state, and we're all just these helpless sheep. And if we haven't got a shepherd with, sheepdogs barking at us, we wouldn't know what to do. We'd all be running amok. But we don't. We don't run amok. We work together. It's in our genes to be community animals, and empathy and charity are there. And of course, we have bad eggs. We have psychopaths who don't have those qualities. And we need, ways to deal with those people. But we currently have a system where those are often the people who rise to the top and start telling us what to do.
That's right. And what happens in that? I've always questioned this a little bit as well. What happens when people are not allowed to take care of some of their own problems? And this is a very tricky question, but we published a couple of articles on this a while back. It was about the bully that arises in school, for example, that it's a very necessary step for the one who is bullied to overcome that issue, to actually deal with that problem, to not only for self-esteem issues, but for the fact that it's a growth process in that. And I feel the same thing is happening on a bigger scale when it comes to, those bad apples that you talked about or whatever. Now we're in a position where we can't deal with it. Again, it's the job of the state. We're not accustomed to how to take care of a problem like that. Let's say we have someone who's completely incapable of living in a smaller community or something like that. Now there's a disability there. We cannot deal with it. We're not allowed to do anything about it. And I'm not talking about lynching the man or anything like that. I'm just talking about of effectively trying to sort out the situation on our own, because this also creates a kind of a dependency on a bigger entity, again, the state. And if this is prolonged through generations, as it has been now, then people do not longer know how to defend themselves. And I think that this is a reflection of why these people have actually ended up at the top of the system and now running us, because we haven't spoken up soon enough. Do you see what I'm getting at?
Absolutely. And we've had an evolutionary gap, if you like, because as you say, the state has been taking care of all this for a long time. And it's hard to know what systems we would develop without them. We certainly wouldn't be spending £40,000 a year putting somebody in prison because they'd, stolen £100 worth of stuff.
Smoked marijuana or something like that.
Yeah. And it's the evolution. Their system hasn't evolved. If you go back a couple hundred years and you look at the justice law and order system, they had police out grabbing people. They had judges sentencing them, fining them, and they had put them in jails. And that's just what they're doing now. If you go back 100 or so years ago with us, we had letters. Then we had, the telephone and the telegraph. We laid cables across the ocean to have the telegraph. Then we got telex and fax. And now we've got smartphones. That's evolution. That's how we deal with it. We've gone from bicycles to jumbo jets. Look at the music that we've evolved. The state is doing exactly the same thing. Now, if that was in our hands, I think we'd have really sophisticated techniques now. And I think we could develop sophisticated techniques within a decade or so that made it very difficult to be a criminal in the first place. You look at the surveillance that the NSA is able to do. If you had a sort of responsible, involved people dealing with law and order, people who benefited when there was less crime and less criminals in the system, we would develop a way of dealing with this that didn't profit by it. That's the real problem right now, because the police, the judges, and the penal system, they all thrive on crime. There's no real inbuilt interest to get rid of it. I have a whole chapter in the book devoted to this, which is a very interesting concept I learned in courses I took in the 70s, 1970s. And everything that I have come across since then has just reaffirmed my idea that this is really the way to deal with crime in a non-coercive manner. So you're not, locking people up and killing them. And of course, if you go back to earlier civilizations, to the German tribes, because the Romans never got across the Rhine. Yeah. And the German tribes had all sorts of systems, and it was maybe when I was written down as Hammurabi, but they had certain restitutions, this many cows or this much gold or whatever you had to pay if you had committed different categories of crime. And communities would get together, they would decide what had happened, and the miscreant who created this crime had to make good, had to get the acceptance of whoever he had harmed that the issue was over, and that was the way to deal with it. Mm-hmm. If that person didn't do that, they were exiled.
That's right, yeah.
And that was as bad as it can get, to be exiled from your community. But that's not putting the guy in shackles. That's not coercive. That's just saying you're out. And of course, today we, even though, we live in big cities and might not know our neighbors, there are ways to severely limit people's activities, whether it's online or with managing their money or their goods or their entertainment. You can really, take things away from people's lives without actually being coercive. So there are ways of managing that we have never really had a chance to evolve. But I do point out that both eBay and Amazon, they've got systems to get rid of rogue traders and sneaky buyers who lie about whether things arrived or not. They have ways of dealing with that don't involve breaking your door down at 6 a.m. or putting you in jail or fining you. They've evolved that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I heard another good example of how the government deals with things. For example, if there's crimes in a park at night, instead of then having, because just to say, the private institutions find different ways of solving this, because otherwise the consumer would walk away, right? It wouldn't work. The incentive is there to really solve it. But I said there's crime in a park at night. Instead of solving the crime and trying to get rid of it, now they're actually enforcing a curfew. Let's say you can't walk into the park after 9 o'clock, and they say, yeah, problem solved, right? So they're putting the blame on the citizen, on the consumer, if you want to put it that way, the mm-hmm. ones to utilize the park kind of thing, and pushing these issues off, into other areas instead, or having the crime moved to this concept. It's pushing around the furniture on the Titanic is not really going to work this way,
Yeah. And it's not going to involve, because the feedback loops are cut. There's important feedback loops that generate change and evolution. The state comes in and they say, nope, you can't go to the park, you can't do this. They just cut that thing and they tell people what to do instead. And that just freezes any sort of positive change from taking place.
Well, indeed. So are we being held back? Is our progress being stifled? I mean, the question is, where would we be today if this wasn't the case? Maybe we'd be, I'd say, out exploring space instead of educating kids in school what words they can't or can't use. I mean, it feels like we've gone backwards, in a lot of ways.
We'd have twice as much money under natural management. I'm talking about real money, because somebody's turned some plastic and metal and wiring into a smartphone, or some clay into a cup, or a seed into a cauliflower. That's adding value to the world. And half or more of that, 70%, is taken away. And And if that's still in the system, there's so much more scope for charity, for goodwill, for looking after ourselves. There's going to be so much less unemployment, hunger, and homelessness as well, because, you know, we have, the money hasn't been sucked out of the system.
Yeah.
It's and people just, that's huge, huge change it would be. And everything the government does is stuff that actually we do. You don't have politicians out doing heart surgery, laying roads, nabbing thieves. It's all stuff that they pay human beings to do. And you know, we can do that ourselves. It's as simple as that.
There's many more aspects of this I want to ask you about later in our discussion here. But how does, just for a moment, switch over, how does things work in nature then? If we look at that, if it, there's something which is happening there, which we seems to be kind of disconnected from. There's no one, as far as we know, is coming in and telling the plant how to grow and in what direction and how many branches it can have or whatnot, how many flowers. It's just it's a natural system there. It's a natural order, and we're still part of that, although we, I guess, to a certain extent have been disconnected from that. But what could we learn if we look at nature and how things operate there?
Well, my favorite example is a rainforest, but you could equally talk about a village pond with all the thousands of different varieties of microbe and plant that live within it. But either that or a huge rainforest, you get a natural order develops. And nobody, as you say, nobody's telling the trees where to grow or the frogs where to go or the rivers, or in a village pond, nobody's saying which bacteria, which microorganisms live there, what plants grow. Nature sorts itself out, and you get, well, we used to get, you know, stable weather systems where you knew when the winds were going to come and when the rains were going to come, and with obviously variation in there. But nature does create harmony, and that's this wonderful science called chaos theory, which was born in the 80s. I discovered in 1990, and I opened a shop devoted to chaos theory. And that was the scientific underpinning that led to me finally bringing this book out, because I realized it wasn't just human nature. It wasn't just principles like coercion doesn't work, or the fact that voting is a kind of a very ineffective way of going forward. But this was scientific proof that we do self-organize, and when you've got lots of, your chaotic system is got more parts than you can count, each of them acting unpredictably and independently, you tend to develop harmony and order and some sort of balance out of that. And that's one of the places we do that, is when we feed a city like Stockholm or London or New York. There's nobody saying who's going to eat what or when or how much they've got to spend, but everybody gets fed by this bottom-up system, which creates this very complex structure that feeds everybody. And of course, if the state had been doing that for the last 50 years, they'd have more and more controls, and you'd have little 10-minute windows you had to eat in, and your food would be determined, and everybody would say, my God, well, without this, we'd all starve. How would we possibly exist without it?
Yeah, exactly. It's a good point. So see, those are some of the other aspects I want to get into later too, in terms of, you know, what people think might arise if we move in a different direction with chaos and, you know, anarchy, and, you know, how do we solve the security issues, all those things. We'll get into that. But what you're mentioning here is about basically in the natural world, there's an adjustment to the circumstances that, sure, there might be an unforeseen issue, like a major volcanic eruption or what have you, but things will adjust according to the new set of rules that arise within the natural system, and things will. I mean, as far as we know, we're still here. The planet is still here. The plants and animals and everything else is still on here. We've managed to survive in some way, right? Adjusting ourselves to these new circumstances, even if they are massively catastrophical. I mean, certainly there have been die-offs, I guess, of species, so we shouldn't be too confident that we're going to be here all the time, right? But nonetheless, I mean, that these are things outside of our control anyway. We have to do the best we can to adjust to these. And instead then, you know, maybe you can talk about that a little bit more. What happens within the state there? I mean, because the state is very stupid, I guess, for the lack of a better term, in terms of how it assesses information, how quickly it responds to things, and by the time it actually does respond to things, it might actually be the wrong thing to begin with, right? So things, it's a counterintuitive way of working with problems that arise.
Yeah, it's it's run, most of our politicians are lawyers, and lawyers don't do cooperation or harmony. It's always either or conflict, winners and losers. So they don't really develop nice, smooth, harmonious systems. And that's it's very hard to get around that situation, because they're always arguing, they're always looking for winners and losers. And I'm trying to remember what your question is now.
Now, it was a little bit more about the adjustment to the circumstances and how the state is trying to, how it usually operates on bad intelligence, I guess, yeah, assessment of the situations of what is needed.
Well, that, yeah, I mean, we had a great example in the EU when they started, yeah, they imposed the controls on fisheries, because to try and save the fish, they end up with a system where half the fish are thrown back in the oceans dead.
Yes, that's right.
And, you know, we had Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, this English cookery celebrity. He took it upon himself to change this, and he had a 2 or 3 year campaign. And he finally got them. Now they're backpedaling. They haven't stopped it yet, but they're looking at how to stop doing that. But it's an insane thing they've done. Now this other thing they're doing, they biofuels with a government objective to try and save the, you know, some environmental benefits. So they have these biofuels that are, you know, taking good cropland away from feeding people and using up more energy to create biofuels, mm-hmm, in most cases, not all cases, than the petrol that they replace. And there's nobody taking that as their particular crusade. So at the moment, almost half of the American maize crop goes into fuel. And still they talk about there's not enough food to feed people, so we have to have genetically modified foods. So yeah, they take on a problem. They got all the inputs from corporate lobbyists, each arguing their own corner. And the one that's made the best case is the one that wins. And lawyers, as we know, they don't really care so much. They don't care as much on whether their client is guilty or innocent as whether they win or lose the case. Prosecutors, right, they want, yeah, to send somebody down, and defendants want to get them off. They're not looking for justice. They're lawyers. So when they're trying to solve problems of the world, they're not looking for justice either. They're just whoever lobbied them best, or in some cases, you know, gave them bribes the best. You know, I'm not going to suggest that though. But that's how they resolve it. And it's not, you don't get, you might accidentally stumble across a solution to something like that, but it would be unusual.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I just want to reiterate that point about the fisheries as well. I mean, that's just amazing. They just to explain this to the audience, I haven't heard about the EU situation, that they catch herring, let's say, or something like that. The fishing boat holds on to them, and then they continue to fish, and let's say that they catch cod or something like that next. And so by law, they're only allowed to keep a certain amount of fish, or if it's by weight, I can't exactly remember how that was. But so they basically end up dumping back the by now dead herring into the ocean and keep the cod, because they say, oh, well, this is a better fish, or we get more for it, kind of thing. I mean, it's just, it's insanity.
It really is. The fishermen don't like it. And when this Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall started his campaign, people at the European Union just, no, this is, you'll never get there, don't waste your time. And he just plotted and plotted. But it's sad that people have to work so hard to overturn something so insane that the state is doing. Because they're much better at making laws than deleting them, basically.
Exactly. That's the direction we should move. Well, we have much more to discuss. I want to ask you a little bit more about these things in the second segment, about the free market and what people think will happen there. Of course, security issues, as I mentioned before, anarchy and all that stuff. But let's give out some of the details, Gregor, where people can find copies of the book. You have a couple of different versions, meaning electronic and hardback or available. Yep. So
it's out on paper, and it's a printed book, and as a digital book. My website is gregorysams.com, and if you Google "the state is out of date" or put it into Amazon, you'll go straight to the book. "The State is Out of Date, We Can Do It Better" is the title. And there is also a website for the book, which is thestateisoutofdate.com. My other book, Son of God, is also on the GregorySams.com website, which we spoke about 4 years ago.
That's right. Yeah.
So the digital version, one of the final sticking points with my publisher is I wanted the digital version out there at a low price, and it is. So it's under a couple of dollars and just over £1 for the instant download version.
GregorySams.com. I also check out The State is Out of Date, and there's a lot of good articles on there as well that kind of speaks to the points made in the chapters. There's a good kind of chapter heading there on the website as well, so you can check out some of the different things that Gregory goes into in the book. Check it out right there. Okay, Gregory, we'll take a short break. We'll be right back with more after this. We'll pick this right up in the second hour as we discuss the concern of the politician and the circus of re-election and mankind's extraordinary ability to come back after setback. We talk about the free market system versus capitalist monopoly systems that led banks like Goldman Sachs to consolidate more wealth and power and control with the aid of government. Public-private partnership is another sinister aspect to this control structure. We discuss security questions and how people believe that anarchy and chaos is the only outcome of a monopoly centralized government rule. Later, we get into the war industry that is by design leading to disruption and mayhem. We talk about how this leads to mass migrations, which in turn leads to massive cultural wars with chaos, strife, and religious conflict where there shouldn't have been one to begin with. The globalists are creating conflict at every turn, as it benefits their agenda. We also have the issue of promises of handouts and the welfare system in the West that drives people in the third world and second world from their homelands. If this system didn't exist, people would instead stay in their own home countries, belong to their cultures, and work for improving locally things in their region instead of uprooting and actually taking some of those issues with them wherever they go. So instead, you get a situation where those people who potentially could actually do something about these problems end up leaving. What kind of world is that creating? We'll pick this up at redicemembers.com. Our second hour is coming up. Sign up and tune in for much more if you're not yet a member. We have, by the way, upcoming as well on the program, E. Michael Jones, Stephen McNallan, and Kyle Hunt, to name a few. And by the way, we'll be at the Secret Space Program Conference here over the weekend now. So if you want to tune in as a last minute measure here, you can do that. This is this Saturday and Sunday then. So check out secretspaceprogram.org for streaming tickets. But we'll pick up right now with Gregory Sams. Stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back. Thank you for listening.